While the events of the past couple of weeks in Israel and Gaza have horrified us all, we're aware that a lot of assumptions have been made as to how much people might know about the history of the region and the context of the troubles that are going on at the moment. So we asked Dr. Vincent Durack, Associate Professor in Middle East Politics in the UCD School of Politics and International Relations, to give us a potted history of how the region has the divisions it has. And I began by asking him why the modern state of Israel is where it is and how it got there.
The modern state of Israel dates back to the declaration of independence of the state of Israel on May 15, 1948. But that, in turn, was the culmination of a process that unfolded over decades. So what you see, in essence, is Israel in its modern incarnation developing as a refuge for the global Jewish population from European anti-Semitism in large part. A combination of that and the success over time of a Jewish nationalist doctrine, which we have come to know as Zionism, which from the middle of the 19th century onwards, and particularly in the early decades of the 20th century, proposed that the solution to the level of discrimination and marginalization that Jews had historically experienced in Europe was the creation of a homeland or a Jewish state. And that in turn was linked by many as a matter of either history or religious belief to the biblical Holy Land.
So, as you say, this culminates in a UN declaration in 1947 to establish a state of Israel in what was then British-controlled Palestine. The Jewish leadership accepts this. The Arabs, who made up the majority of the population there, reject the division of Palestine.
Yes, absolutely. And the territory that we now know as Palestine, Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, had come under British control after World War I. Previously, it had been subject to the control of the Ottoman Empire. But from the end of the First World War until 1947, the British were in charge. And over the course of that period, from quite early on, in 1917, the British had declared their support for the establishment of Jewish homeland in Palestine, notwithstanding the fact that there were a significant number of Palestinian Arabs living in Palestine. And over the course of the mandate, the British mandate, what took place was increasing levels of Jewish immigration into Palestine. And that, of course, became markedly more significant with the events of the Holocaust in Germany, aroused a great deal of unsurprising Arab and Palestinian hostility on all sides, in fact, when the British belatedly limited Jewish immigration to Palestine in 1939 of all years. You then see very significant anti-British Jewish violence. And all of this culminated in the British handing over the problem to the UN. And the UN, as you've noted, passed a General Assembly resolution which proposed the partition of Palestine, which saw the Jewish population, which was roughly one third of the total, being granted roughly 56% of Palestine, and the Palestinian Arab population and the Palestinian state that was proposed receiving 43%, notwithstanding that they were, significantly outnumbered the Jewish population. The remaining 1% was Bethlehem and Jerusalem, and was to be a sort of international zone, as it were.
Because of
their significance for
Christians.
For Christians primarily. And Muslims and Jews.
Post-1948 then, there's a declaration of Israeli independence. The nearby Arab powers, with varying levels of commitment, attack the new independently declared Israeli state, which roughly corresponds with the 1947 UN borders. What happens?
On the Israeli side, the new state of Israel expanded the territory under its control so that roughly 77% of Mandate Palestine now came under Israeli control. On the Arab side, what many Palestinians, indeed what many other observers would see as happening, was not much more than a land grab. The Jordanians moved into what is now the West Bank, took control. Egypt took control of what is now the Gaza Strip. And little or no commitment to Palestinian statehood. Indeed, many would argue that neighbouring Arab states really had no interest in the emergence of an independent Palestinian state.
And what happens to the Palestinians within what is now modern Israel during the course of that war in 1948?
Over the course of what the Israelis refer to as the War of Independence, and the Arab world and Palestinians more specifically refer to as Anakba, the catastrophe, you see a number of significant developments, and perhaps the most significant is the expulsion, or the official Israeli perspective is, you know, the voluntary movement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to neighbouring states, or indeed within Palestine, to the extent that most of the present-day inhabitants of Gaza, for instance, are the descendants of Palestinian refugees in 1948.
Now, many things happen up until 1967, when Israel launches a preemptive strike against Syria and Egypt, and Jordan later becomes involved in the war. 1967 is the beginning of what we now hear about being the occupied territories. What happens in 1967?
Yeah, 67 is absolutely central to, well, Middle Eastern politics in general, and absolutely crucial to Arab, Israeli and Palestinian Israeli conflicts. Prior to 67, you had a great deal of saber rattling on the part of, you know, what would have been radical socialist oriented regimes in Syria and in Egypt about liberating Palestine. And in essence, the Israelis launched a preemptive strike, fearing that they were going to be attacked by what were reasonably well-equipped and well-trained armies. And in the shortest time, the six-day war for a reason, in fact, a two-day war, they destroyed the Egyptian and Syrian and later the Jordanian air forces. And then in the course of the six-day war, occupied the West Bank, occupied Jerusalem. East Jerusalem had been under Jordanian control, and occupied the Gaza Strip, and also occupied Syrian territory in the Golan, which we tend to forget about. So now you get the starting point, if you like, for subsequent developments in terms of Israeli control over all of Palestine.
Okay, now there's another war fought by Egypt and Syria simultaneously attack Israel in 1973 in what's known as the October War or the Ramadan War or the Yom Kippur War, depending on where you're coming from. But to look at the Israel-Palestine aspect of this, Israel builds up and beds down its occupation of the lands it takes in 1967, and this continues apace. Things begin to change somewhat in those dynamics in the 1980s, though.
Yes, you get a sense on the part both of the Arab frontline states and indeed of the Israelis, that Israel cannot simply dominate the region militarily. And some in Israel begin to recognize this. And the first sign of that is the mutual recognition of Egypt and Israel, the establishment of diplomatic relations. And that then begins to feed into some shift on the Israeli side towards negotiation with the Palestinians more broadly, as well as with neighboring states. And ultimately, you see this culminating after the first Gulf War in a reasonably serious attempt being made at Madrid by the US administration of George Bush Sr. And his Secretary of State, James Baker, to bring those concerned to the negotiating table. But the negotiating process was flawed in very significant ways.
And there is then the Oslo process, which leads to a peace agreement that's signed where the PLO, the representatives of the Palestinian people, in exchange for recognising Israel, they negotiate with Israel. And then there is this what is known as land for peace trade-off. What is that and how does it go after the mid-1990s?
Yeah, with Oslo, which followed a remarkable set of sort of back-channel negotiations involving Norwegian diplomats and academics, what you get is the famous Declaration of Principles, mutual recognition of Israel on the one hand by the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and recognition by Israel of the PLO as the sort of the vehicle for Palestinian nationalist aspirations. And then you get a deal of sorts being charted, which would see a level of Palestinian self-government in parts of the West Bank, but a sort of vague reference to further self-government over a five-year period, and very little done to address critical issues that, you know, were at the heart of the conflict, including where a Palestinian state might ultimately be, refugees, whether or not they had the right to return, under what circumstances they might, the status of Jerusalem, and so on and so forth.
Taking us forward then to what we have seen, the events of this week, people have heard a lot about Hamas and the following the attack that was mounted by Hamas militants on Israel that killed 1,400 civilians. Who are they and why are they in control of the Gaza Strip? They don't lead the Palestinian people everywhere in territory that's under Palestinian control. So why are they in control in Gaza?
Hamas emerged initially in the late 80s. Its exact origins are a little murky. And it came to prominence in particular in the First Intifada, that sort of popular uprising, which expressed frustration on the part of Palestinians at a very stagnant status quo. It describes itself in its charter as an Islamic nationalist movement. So it fuses religion and nationalism. It came to further prominence in 2006 when, having initially and indeed identified itself with rejection of everything to do with the Oslo Accords, Hamas agreed to participate in elections to the Palestinian National Council. And arising out of mismanagement of an election, mismanagement of candidates and widespread suspicion of corruption, amongst other things, Hamas actually won an outright majority on the PNC, on the Palestinian National Council. That led almost immediately to sanctions on the part of the US, which were latterly supported by the European Union, and something in the form of an attempted coup in Gaza in particular to overthrow Hamas, where it was at its strongest. Hamas defeated the efforts of the Palestinian Liberation Organization to unseat it. The PLO was essentially forced out and Hamas reigned supreme in Gaza and has done ever since.
Right, and it should be stressed that those elections in the mid-2000s are the last elections that Palestinians have had the opportunity to participate in to elect a leadership. So there had been a view that despite the upsurges in violence between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, rockets being launched and reprisals by Israel, that Hamas was moderating its position. It had been committed to the destruction of the state of Israel, but by 2017 they had moderated their position to a point where, if not explicitly recognising it, were prepared to put up with the existence of Israel, and they appeared to be going down some kind of a political track. Any thought of that has been cleared away in the last couple of weeks following that attack.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, the very fact of participation in the 2006 elections signified to many a huge shift in Hamas thinking. And this is not a homogenous organisation. There are those who are more militarily oriented and those who are more oriented towards the political process. That remains the case to this day. And certainly there have been very clear indicators, for instance, of a willingness on the part of senior leaders of Hamas to rewrite their infamous charter, which calls for the destruction of Israel, to make pragmatic deals with Israel. They have done, they've negotiated over several issues in the course of the past couple of decades. But undoubtedly, the events of the last 8 or 9 days have destroyed those prospects.
All right, that was Vincent Durack, who is Associate Professor of Middle East Politics in UCD, speaking to us before the programme. And I hope that's of help to anyone who wasn't familiar with some of the issues of the last 75 years of history in the region. Still with us here in studio is Jane Matthews from thejournal.ie, Green TD Patrick Costello, Sinn Féin TD John Brady, and Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance Tanya Ward. Jane, to you first. This was debated in the Dáil last night. The situation that's ongoing at the moment was debated in the Dáil last night. Different views on between government and opposition, although large points of agreement. What was ultimately decided at the end of last night's debate, and what was the tone of that debate like?
Yeah, so I think from watching it, the overall sense I got was that there was a pretty united front across the whole political spectrum, really. In the end, the motion was passed. It was calling for a ceasefire and for humanitarian corridors to be opened into and out of Gaza. You know, the Taoiseach Micheál Martin opened the debate and he announced then that Ireland was increasing its aid to the UN. Sinn Féin also backed the motion, and they kind of, Mary Lou McDonnell likened it to the Troubles. And a lot of people did say that Ireland was in a unique position to kind of act as a peace broker if that was something that was needed. But yeah, the overall message was that the actions from Hamas were condemned. But then there was also a strong focus on calling for focusing on the humanitarian element of the conflict.
All right. Patrick Costello, let's look at some practical action that Ireland could achieve. It's involved in two big multilateral organisations that have some influence on the situation, the United Nations and the European Union. Let's start with the European Union. What practical measures should the Irish government be taking within the European Union to alleviate the suffering of the people in Gaza immediately and to deal with Israel, to convince it to allow in humanitarian aid whilst at the same time reassuring its security concerns?
Well, I think First of all, I think the only thing that we should be doing is trying to uphold international law. It is the only independent yardstick against which the actions of people can be judged. And we need to hold that up as the important thing. And I don't think President von der Leyen going off as she did, ignoring international law, ignoring her own previous statements in international law, is really the sort of thing the European
Union. Sure, but I suppose Ireland in its capacity on the European Council will no doubt seek to wrap the European Commission's knuckles along with Luxembourg and Spain and a number of others. But that being done, what should Ireland do?
Well, I think if we look at what happened with the invasion of Ukraine, when we saw Russian aggression, Russian breaches of international law, there was restrictive measures applied to Russia. And we need to look at international law, and we apply restrictive measures to Hamas already. And I believe the European Union should be applying these to the state of Israel for its ongoing egregious breaches of international law, not just in the last 2 weeks, but across the last 75 years. And I think it's very important because, you know, one of the things in that piece, there was no mention of the daily violence used to uphold and to continue the occupation on a daily basis in the West Bank. So we need to be asking for that, and we need to be looking for that. I'm realistic, and I don't believe that'll happen. There's enough states out there that are not supportive of the Palestinian cause, that are supportive of Israel, and will not be supportive in any way of the sort of restrictive measures we should see.
And that being said, there are some practical measures that the European Union can take, surely, that reflect both positions. The states that have better relations with Israel might, for example, try and prevail upon them not to rely on the one-lane access point through the Rafah crossing, but to allow access through Kerem Shalom, which is set up for inspections and a greater volume of goods entering Gaza. But Ireland, it's unlikely, would be listened to by Israel on that, isn't it?
I do think that you're right when you say that, yes. But I think this is, if we look at, and again, a piece I would argue with in relation to the history there, the mutual recognition with Egypt came after significant American pressure. Every withdrawal or every concession by Israel has come after significant pressure. So we need to be putting that pressure on Israel to say your actions are not good enough.
But the United States also abstained on a Security Council resolution expressing concerns about the expansion of settlements, and they've expanded since then. And John Brady, I suppose there's a lot we could have covered in an hour on the history, but that's what the time allowed to us was. John Brady, the specific practical measures that Ireland can take in order to dial down the situation and provide humanitarian relief where it's needed most, what's the single most important measure Ireland could take?
Well, I think last night's vote in the Dáil was a starting point. It's one of the first parliaments in the world to actually call for a ceasefire. That's important. That's significant. I think it was a gross failure within the European Union, the resolution that was passed today, calling for a humanitarian pause. In other words, you know, telling Israel it's, you know, pause, go and get some lunch and, you know, renew.
But that's
your,
what compromise looks like. That reflects what might happen at a European Council level if the government were to bring a position to the table. It wouldn't get its own way with its European partners.
And that's where there's difficulties and challenges within the European Union. And, you know, Sinn Féin have constantly been saying, you know, the position of the Irish government trying to build broad consensus across the EU is doomed to fail. And that has been their, you know, their stock reply in terms of taking actions that are within the powers of the Irish government, moving forward the Occupied Territories Bill, ceasing the fact that they've made Irish taxpayers, part of a process of, you know, investing us in illegal actions by making us stakeholders within businesses operating in the many illegal colonial settlements that have sprung up since Oslo. Actions that the Irish government can take.
What would you like
lead
to see? What would you like to see the Irish government do on a practical level in the immediate term?
I mean, I think the Irish government has got the politics of this right in the public statement statements that it's made in recognising the war crimes that were committed against civilians in Israel, and also the war crimes that have since been committed against the Palestinians in Gaza as well. And it's one of the honest brokers now, actually, internationally in this area. And it has its links at the EU level, and it has its links with the US government as well. And it has a good style of diplomacy, which is really important. But we have to go back to what's happening. War crimes are being committed. And who has jurisdiction to address that? It's the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And I think pressure should be put on the International Criminal Court to get them to make a preemptive statement about what they are seeing. Like, they have jurisdiction over Gaza. The Palestinian Occupied Authority signed up to that convention. Israel didn't, but Palestine did. So they have jurisdiction to investigate Hamas for what they did in Israel. They also have jurisdiction to investigate Israel for what they're doing.
Would it undermine
in Gaza
their credibility to make a preemptive statement about what's going on? Or should they first argue for access in order to investigate what's going on and then have a conclusion based on evidence?
They have moved away from preemptive statements. But here is the thing. There's a lot of documentation already. And we are watching. We are about to watch Israel go in and invade Gaza. Right, how can you sit back and watch and not intervene?
We have to take a break. We have to take a break. We're back after this.
The Late Debate with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.